we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover, starting with liquor prices and coverage thereof.
Yes, I was not surprised by some of the media coverage of the liquor privatization and the results of it, but I find it extremely funny to read some of the quotes in the news stories, you know, where people are saying, "Oh, I voted for I-1183 and expected liquor prices to be lower, and they're not, they're higher."
You know, after all of the news coverage from the Seattle Times about how liquor prices are higher and people are concerned about this, I'm still waiting for the retraction from the editorial board of all those assurances that this was going to be good for consumers and prices were going to be lower.
That they endorsed I-1183 because it was going to bring liquor prices down, and of course that hasn't happened.
They endorsed I-1183 because they have a major advertiser with skin in the game.
Yes, and you know, the whole idea was people should vote for I-1183 because it would bring prices down, which has not happened.
And better selection, which has not happened.
Selection and better variety, which has not happened, you know. And so people are upset. They have to drive around to a dozen grocery stores to find their brand, you know. And once they found their brand, they can't be assured it's going to be there because it's still early in the game and stores are still deciding what they want to stock. So
and how much of it?
Yeah, and how much of it? And you can't be surprised by this because grocery stores, sure, they can devote an aisle, a whole aisle, to booze, which they've been doing, I have to say. But you know, one aisle in a grocery store is not going to make up for a whole large store. And some of the liquor store, in fact, most of the liquor stores in Western Washington were fairly large. A whole large liquor store devoted to a variety of different brands at a reasonable price. Now, I just want to point out too that a lot of this coverage is saying that taxes are the cause of the higher prices. And in fact, taxes are the same as they were before the liquor privatization.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And it's really the fact that now instead of just distributors taking a markup, you have distributors and retailers taking a markup.
The reason they're talking about taxes is because taxes, the way that the private stores are listing the prices does not include the tax, whereas it was actually included when it was at the state liquor store.
Yeah, so you didn't know what the tax was when you were buying at the state liquor store, and now you see what the tax is when you get rung up at a retail store. Now, also, I want to point out, too, that Costco, who financed most of the initiative, they haven't raised their prices as much as some of the other stores around town because they're a big national chain, and they buy in volume. They can take a cut on the margin to keep prices low, but that's not going to last forever. So even though people are saying, "Oh, I can get it cheaply at Costco,"
they're waiting for the market to shake out.
Yeah, they're waiting for other stores to be driven out of business so that they can seize much of the market share before they bring their prices up to what it will ordinarily be. So people can go to Costco and they can say, "Look, it works. I'm, you know, prices are fairly low. I'm not paying any more than I was before. In fact, it's a little cheaper." Well, that's because Costco's taken a hit to provide you with cheap booze to drive their competitors out of business.
Yeah, that's the way drug pushers work too.
And there's still a membership fee at Costco on top of all that.
Oh, so. Yeah, there is.
And I would add to all of that this is not an anomaly. This is what happens every time a privatization scheme is sold, whatever it is, whether it's retail goods or utilities or public resources, whatever it might be. It is always sold as increasing competition, providing benefits to the consumer, and it never, ever, ever works out that way because there's more middle people who have to make a profit in the private sector.
Yep.
Every time it's going to work out this way, and every time it is going to be sold as being beneficial, and it never will be.
All right. Moving on.
It's not to make you drink.
Can't
afford to drown your sorrows anymore. SPD making a lot of news this week.
Oh, yeah. There were three big stories this week regarding the SPD. SPD Lieutenant Donnie Lowe was arrested for domestic violence, and it turns out he has had at this point a leadership role in implementing the 2020 plan announced by Mayor McGinn and the SPD to try to, quote-unquote, reform the Seattle Police Department, but not deal with biased policing. Now, Lowe allegedly got drunk at a party at his house and pushed his wife against a wall and smacked her. The Seattle Times described him as having a checkered history with the department because he'd had an arrest in 2008 for a DUI. He had a blood alcohol level of 0.113, which is above the state limit of 0.08.
And yet this is still the guy, even before this latest incident, who is put partially in charge of the 2020 plan.
Yeah, and he pleaded guilty to an amended charge of reckless driving. I'm not sure how that charge got amended from a DUI. His sentence was deferred, and then the charges were dismissed after he finished an alcohol information class and some community service. Apparently, that alcohol information class didn't take, and apparently the department didn't take it into account when they gave him a leadership role in implementing the 2020 plan. So that's, I think, pointing to some problems there at the department. Also this week, city attorneys filed court documents challenging the Department of Justice report that said the SPD had a pattern of biased policing. Now, in the lawsuit against SPD, this was in the lawsuit against SPD officer Shandy Cobain. You may remember him. He's the guy who was caught on cell phone video uttering a racial slur and stomping on a suspect. This was when he told
quote, "I'm going to beat the bleeping Mexican bleep
piss
out of you."
Yeah,
yes,
out of you. And at the time, Chief Diaz, SPD Chief Diaz, demoted Shandy Cobain and said that if any other officer engaged in the same kind of racial slur, that he might fire them. Now the city
and also both he and Cobain were forced to apologize.
Yes, and now city attorneys are asking the judge in the Shandy Cobain case not to allow the DOJ report into evidence and to dismiss the lawsuit. That I think is going pretty far. Cobain, in fact, in his lawsuit has testified in a deposition that 2 years after the incident, he still doesn't know what the SPD's policy is on unbiased policing, which I think points to the fact that there probably isn't a policy on unbiased policing in the SPD.
There were also several other depositions in the case from officers that were involved in the case that basically pointed to the idea that Cobain's behavior was considered acceptable and normal, and still considered acceptable and normal for controlling a situation.
It really, and
that this was considered acceptable in the SPD culture. This again is a situation where there's a larger cultural problem within SPD, and rather than try to address that cultural problem as part of a reform effort, the city is engaged in a pattern of denial. And, you know, this is particularly troubling coming from the city attorney's office, which is trying to undermine the credibility and trustworthiness, that's a direct quote of the DOJ report, rather than taking the concerns of the federal investigation to heart. And it's doing so in the city attorney's office's case, Pete Holmes, from a guy who was elected to the city attorney's office originally in 2009 based upon his history as an advocate for police accountability.
Yeah.
So he has done a 180 on this. McGinn has been an extreme disappointment in this. Diaz has been a tool since he became the permanent chief. It really has been a shameful reaction by SPD and city political leadership all the way around.
Yeah. And then the third bit of news on the SPD this week was the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, a 3-judge panel, ruled that John Kita can pursue a civil rights lawsuit against the SPD. Kita was arrested in February 2008 on a suspected assault charge, arguing with his girlfriend. Dash cam video showed the SPD officer, Kevin Oshikawa Clay, slamming Kita's face against the hood of his patrol car and then dragging him to the ground, where he kneeled on Kita's back, hit him a couple more times, and then cranked his arm into a pain compliance hold. SPD commanders and a lieutenant in the training division reviewed the dash cam video, and they all concluded that Oshikawa Clay had been following department policy by slamming Kita's face into the hood of his car, even though on the dash cam video it appeared that Kita was not resisting arrest. And in fact, Kita was never charged with resisting arrest, and he was eventually acquitted of the assault charge that he was arrested for. He's now suing the SPD because he has some medical issues after having his face slammed into the hood of the car and being drugged to the ground, having him probably the back of his head. You can't really see on the dash cam video where he was hit by Clay, but it appears that from the angle it may have been the back of his head. The three-member panel of the Ninth Circuit Court ruled that Clay's actions were, quote, objectively unreasonable and therefore constitutionally excessive, even though his commanders ruled that, yes, he had followed SPD policy.
Those are not mutually exclusive, by the way.
Yeah.
Let's move on to national, starting with the Paycheck Fairness Act.
Yeah, all the national media political attention this past Tuesday was on the recall election in Wisconsin. Really, a better bellwether of what the Republican Party in the United States has become was happening in the U.S. Senate, where the Paycheck Fairness Act of 2012 was up for a vote. This was a piece of legislation which would have made it easier for women to seek out redress for the fact that still in the 21st century, women with the same qualifications and doing the same job for the same amount of time as men receive substantially less on average in pay for the same work. This act, unfortunately, was filibustered by the Republicans, and every single Republican in the Senate,
including
all 43
the
of them, including all six, I believe, of the female Republican senators, voted to filibuster against it, and therefore it failed. The particularly interesting thing about this, in addition to the revealing window into the Republican hive mindset, is that this was not considered particularly noteworthy by American media. While you had this election drama playing out in Wisconsin, here you have an issue that is directly impacting the daily lives of half the workforce in the United States. And
more than half
the workforce in the
United States. Half the population.
More than half the population. Yeah. Probably about half the workforce. And it got very little media attention. It was actually quite remarkable. And it makes one wonder whether that might have something to do with the publishers and editors of major national news outlets primarily still being male and getting paid more for it.
Yes, indeed.
All right.
We're not really allowing Maria to weigh in on this, by the way.
Yeah, I'm not allowed to have an opinion, and yeah, you know. Yeah.
But she does have to work twice as hard.
Yeah, but it was a pretty sad day when I read about it. I was like, yeah, I'm not surprised. This is kind of the history of women in the workforce, is that we work hard, but we don't get the same amount of pay. And of course, we don't get the same amount of coverage. And it's interesting too, there's a lot of coverage on gay rights at the moment. And yet it's always taken for granted that women have equality, even though the Equal Rights Amendment never passed, and we still struggle with issues of fairness in the workplace.
All right. Let's move on to a federal court ruling this week on DOMA.
Yes, and speaking of gay rights, and the fact that half of all
that's gay... not to take away from gay rights. Gay
no,
rights
no,
is a very important issue.
And speaking of the fact that, contrary to some media coverage of it, half of all gay people are also women.
Yes.
And one of those women is a woman named Effie Windsor. And she had a lawsuit that was settled in a federal appeals court in New York this week against the Defense of Marriage Act. It became the third time in recent times that the Defense of Marriage Act has been found unconstitutional. In this case, the ruling had to do with... I forgot to turn my cell phone off. In this case, the ruling had to do with Windsor's late partner of 44 years leaving her estate, and Windsor having to pay estate tax on it because they were not legally married. And she made the argument that, well, you know, if it had been a heterosexual marriage and they had been, their marriage had been legally recognized under federal law, they were in New York State, so it was actually recognized under New York State law. But if it had been recognized under federal law, she wouldn't have had to pay estate tax. And the court agreed with her. This now becomes, again, the third such ruling this year against the Defense of Marriage Act. Another notable aspect of this is that because the Obama's Department of Justice is not defending DOMA in court, Republican House Leader John Boehner has set up a PAC called BLAG. I forget the acronym of it, and you can probably make up your own less flattering acronym, has been actually taking the lead in defending against these lawsuits on behalf of the government. And Boehner's PAC was making the legal argument that Windsor's 44-year partnership with her lover was an homosexual homosexuality was a matter of choice because early on in the 1950s, she had a one-year marriage to a man. And this, of course, particularly in those days, is a fairly typical arc for young adults trying to figure out their sexuality in a society that didn't either recognize or respect it. So that actually got laughed out of court once again. Mm-hmm. And so you have, again, these arguments that are being made by Republican culture warriors that have no basis in science and no basis in life that is actually really lived, now getting also laughed out of the federal court system. And it is very encouraging for the prospect that DOMA might eventually be found unconstitutional, even by this U.S. Supreme Court. Yes. And it is certainly going to the Supreme Court. That's where it'll finally be decided.
All right. Also this week, a marriage equality poll.
Yeah, in Missouri, a very interesting poll of African Americans finding that now some in the wake of President Obama's evolution on the question of marriage equality, some 50% of African Americans polled in the state of Missouri now support marriage equality. Only 31% oppose. That is in contrast to another poll that was taken before Obama's announcement, in which 25% were in favor and 44% were opposed. That is a 38% swing. That is a huge change. This comes on the heels of similar polls in Pennsylvania and in Maryland and nationally, showing substantial swings in African American support for marriage equality, specifically with the catalyst for the change being Obama's change stance. And the reason I point this out above and beyond the significance of the issue itself is this raises the question of Obama's failure to use his podium and his bully pulpit and his media visibility on any number of other issues over the course of his administration.
From healthcare reform to global warming.
Healthcare reform, global warming, closing Guantanamo.
A number of things.
You know, the public option, you know, a whole list of things in which Obama's defenders have said, well, the power of the presidency to influence this debate is actually fairly limited. No, it's not. And bear in mind, this was one announcement and one decision, not a sustained campaign of advocacy. So that while Obama's announcement on marriage equality has not at this point actually changed any laws or any policy, it can change the public debate and it can change the framing of the public debate. And it's been a real shame that that hasn't happened more often in his administration.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on to international, starting with the European financial crisis.
Yeah, this week Spain was dragged into the European financial crisis. Now I just want to point out that all of the stuff that's been done around Greece, the hooking them on austerity measures and getting them to accept a bailout where the funds don't even really go into the Greek government accounts, they go directly into the pockets of the bankers that own Greek public debt. This was all meant to try to keep Spain out of the crisis. But that hasn't worked, apparently, because this week Spain had to start making noises about how its banking sector is going to need a bailout from the European Bailout Fund. Now, this is not a sovereign debt problem that Spain has. At least it wasn't initially a sovereign debt problem, because before the crisis, the Spain government didn't have any deficits. It was after their real estate, after their real estate prices collapsed, Spain's banks began to teeter because they had made lots of risky loans, just like banks did here in the United States. The difference is the Spanish government doesn't have the power and isn't as big as the U.S. government, can't sit down and start shoveling billions and billions of dollars into its own banks. So it's asking now the European Union to help put together what's going to probably turn out to be about $126 billion in U.S. dollars worth of aid for Spanish banks. Now, the Spanish government, because Spain is in a double-dip recession where they have more than 24% unemployment, the Spanish government has a deficit now, and it's not a good one. It's not one that will be easy to pay off because tax revenues have been so low. Spanish government has had to borrow in order to cover their expenses. This week, the Spanish government issued bonds that had an interest rate of between 6% and 7%, which is an unsustainable interest rate for the Spanish government to pay in this kind of economic climate. So we'll see. It seems that the Spanish government, which was in fairly good financial straits before the economic crisis hit and before banks drug it down, is now going the way of Greece, it appears.
Moving on, Syria.
Yeah, for the yesterday, for the second time in a week, there was a major massacre in Syria. This time in a small village that was fairly close to the first village in Homs province that was a site of a massacre last Saturday. This time, 78 people, mostly again women and children, were killed by a pro-government militia.
Almost two-thirds of the population of the village.
Yeah, it's only about 140, 150 people living in the village.
Yeah, and the village was completely depopulated when UN monitors were finally able to get through and look at the damage. There were no people left in the village at all.
Yeah, and the couple of things that were particularly significant about this one in terms of the UN were, first of all, there have been a number of reports that when the call first went out to UN observers that this was taking place, those pleas for assistance were ignored. Then when UN observers did try and get to the site, they were blocked from doing so, and in fact actually came under small arms fire and trying to get there, and were not able to get to the village until the following day.
Yeah, and when they did finally arrive there, as I said, the village was depopulated. All the bodies had been taken away, so clearly there was a cover-up going on.
Yeah. This represents a couple of things. Number one, at this point, I think it's safe to assume that the Assad government is engaged and its allies are engaging in this as a specific strategy, an escalation from opening fire on demonstrators and then opening fire on cities and towns that are amenable to demonstrators. Now they're just randomly massacring people as a way to try and again instill fear and suppress a revolt that has yet to be suppressed. It also shows the complete and utter failure of the UN observer process.
Yeah.
And the ceasefire that the UN helped negotiate in March, none of the provisions of which have been honored by the Syrian government. Now you've got a situation where civil war is developing, where there are armed resistance groups developing as well, armed fighters coming in from outside the country, and it's looking to become an increasingly unstable and an increasingly complicated situation involving not just forces internal to Syria, but all of the various countries around Syria.
Yeah.
As well.
And what it's looking like to me is it's looking a lot like the beginnings of the Balkans War, when you had militias forming along ethnic or religious lines and attacking each other, and you had massacres going on under the very noses of so-called UN monitors who didn't, and in this case can't, intervene because they're not armed and not able to prevent this from happening.
Yes, but in this case it's actually even worse because it's not just indigenous militias, but it's militias that are also getting outside support.
Oh, that was happening in the Balkans.
Oh, I know
as
it
well.
Was too, yeah. But in this case you're talking about Israel, you're talking about Saudi Arabia, you're talking about Iran, you're talking about Turkey.
And possibly Al-Qaeda.
And possibly Al-Qaeda, forces in Lebanon, all sorts of different factors are coming into play in this, and it just has the potential to get extremely ugly, and the international community doesn't know what to do because there are no good options.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, the suicide rate with the U.S. troops.
Yeah, several reports this week, starting with an AP report showing that the suicide rate of U.S. Armed Forces soldiers and troops going dramatically higher this year. So far in 2012 through early June, 154 U.S. suicides. That's compared to soldier suicides and soldiers and armed force suicides. That compared to 130 for the same period in 2011 and 123 for the same period in 2010. Mind you, in those 2 years, we still had large numbers of troops in active combat duty in Iraq. So we have fewer troops in harm's way in 2012, yet more suicides going on. More people having died by suicide this year, 154 so far, than have died in the war in Afghanistan, 124. And this speaks to all kinds of problems with how the Army is handling this, a lack of resources and commitment to the problem from the VA, stigmatizing of people who are trying to get counseling and trying to get help within the armed forces. Of course, a lot of people in the armed forces, they're worried about their families because people back home don't have jobs and are in economic trouble. There's just all sorts of repeat deployments.
There's the pressure to deploy, you may have some very serious psychological issues that should be dealt with first.
Yeah, and physical issues sometimes, yes, in the case of head traumas. Well. So there's all kinds of problems that need to be dealt with here that are not being dealt with at a balcony level, policy level, in terms of both the management of the Pentagon and the resources that are being allocated by Congress. And it's an issue that needs a lot more attention.
All right. Just about a minute to back up and cover an item that I missed for under our national domestic terrorism arrest this week.
Oh, yes. 13th member of a Central Florida neo-Nazi group called the American Front was arrested. Apparently, this is a group that was planning domestic terrorism act, doing paramilitary training in Osceola County near Orlando and not too far from Sanford, Florida, oddly enough.
Yeah, and are you surprised you haven't heard about this on the
news? this arrest, by the way, was on May 19th, and there is absolutely nothing about it in U.S. media coverage because none of them are Muslim, quite frankly. They all seem to be white. In fact, I pretty much guarantee they're all white. And,
it's, or at least they think they're all white.
They think they're all white. Yes, that's a very important distinction. And, it's the sort of thing where if they say it's about race and they act as though it's about race, we can't really cover it because in this country, in our media coverage, it's never about race.
Yes, racism doesn't exist here in the United States, apparently,
according
to the media.
No, we're beyond all that. Just like gender inequality in paychecks.
So it shouldn't be surprising that the SPD thinks that it's never about race.
No.
Events.
Yes. Speaking of support for armed forces, Coffee Strong is having its second annual Bullathon this afternoon. By all means, go and check that out and offer your support for Coffee Strong and GI Coffee House outside Fort Lewis that does awesome work. The Bullathon itself will be at Pacific Lanes in Tacoma at 7015 South D Avenue, again in Tacoma. That's at 1 o'clock this afternoon. Also, you may have heard in the 7:30 segment, Dennis Bernstein, longtime KPFA host, with a new book out. He's doing a couple appearances this weekend. One of them will be this afternoon at 5 o'clock at the University Temple, the United Methodist Church at 43rd and 15th Northeast in the Seattle's University District. And then tomorrow in Lake Forest Park at 5:30. I think that time was announced incorrectly in the 7:30 hour. 5:30 at Third Place Books in Lake Forest Park.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find some of my work at mariatomczyk.com.